Virameta,
desist.
Yada,
when.
Chittam,
the mind.
Hitva,
giving up.
Vritti trayam,
the functions of material life
in the three phases
of waking sleep and deep sleep.
Svayam,
automatically.
Yogena,
by regulated spiritual practice.
Va,
or
tada,
then
Atmanam,
the Supreme Soul.
Veda,
he knows.
Ihaya,
from material endeavor.
Nivartite,
he ceases.
Translation purport by the disciples of Srila Prabhupada.
Either automatically or because of one's regulated spiritual practice, one's mind may stop functioning on the material platform of waking consciousness, sleep, and deep sleep. Then one understands the Supreme Soul and withdraws from material endeavor. Purport. As stated in Srimad Bhagavatam 3:25-33, Jharayat Yashu Yakosham Nirgirnam analo yata. Bhakti, devotional service, dissolves the subtle body of the living entity without separate endeavor, just as a fire in the stomach digests all that we eat. The subtle material body is inclined to exploit nature through sex, greed, false pride, and madness. Loving service to the Lord, however, dissolves the stubborn false ego and lifts one to pure, blissful consciousness, Krishna consciousness, the sublime perfection of existence. Okay, we'll just next few chapters, don't really have purports, and just complete the end of the chapter. So we'll read through from 22. Evam lakshana lakshani puranani paravida munayos tadasa prabhu shulakani mahanticha. Sages expert in ancient histories have declared that the Puranas, according to their various characteristics, can be divided into 18 major Puranas and 18 secondary Puranas. Raman Padman Vaishnavamscha Shaivam Lingam Sagarudam Naradiyam Bhagavatam Agneyam Skanda Sangitam Bhavishyam Brahma Vaivarta Markandeyam Savamanam Varaham Macham Kaurmam Cha Brahmandakyamiti Shusat. The 18 major Puranas are the Brahma, Padma, Vishnu, Shiva, Linga, Garuda, Narada, Bhagavat, Agni, Skanda, Bhavishya, Brahma Vivarta, Markandeya, Vamana, Varaha, Matsya, Kurma, and Brahmanda Puranas. Report. Srila Jiva Goswami is quoted from the Varaha Purana, Shiva Purana, and Matsya Purana in confirmation of the above two verses. And text 25. Brahmanidam samakhyatam shaka pranayam mune shishya shishya shishyanam brahmatejo vivardhanam. I have thoroughly described to you, O Brahman, the expansions of the branches of the Vedas by the great sage Vyasadeva, his disciples, and the disciples of his disciples. One who listens to this narration will increase in spiritual strength. Thus ends the purports of the humble servants of his divine grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, to the 12th canto, 7th chapter of Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled Puranic Literatures. Om Jnana Kamrandisha Gananjana Salakaya Shaksurun Minitamina Tasma Shri Gurave Namaha Panchakopa Trubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Bhyebhyascha Patitano Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. So what I'm doing today, just so I don't lose you completely in my organization here, is I'm going to discuss these last verses about the Puranas first, and then talk a little bit about Vrindavan Das Thakur, and then I'm going to go back to this main verse with the purport at the end. Hope that makes sense? All right. So here we go. So this chapter has been about the Puranas, and it's described here that there are 18 major Puranas and 18 minor Puranas, and they cover 10 subject matters. The major Puranas cover 10 subject matters. The minor Puranas cover 5 subject matters. And earlier in the chapter, verses 9 and 10 describe the 10 topics in the Puranas, which were the creation of the universe, subsequent creation of worlds and beings, the maintenance of all living beings, their sustenance, the rule of various Manus, the dynasties of great kings, the activities of such kings, annihilation, motivation, and the supreme shelter. That's, of course, the supreme shelter being Krishna. So we have just read the listing of the 18 major Puranas. As we know from Srila Prabhupada's commentaries and purports that there are 6 Puranas for each of the modes of nature. It doesn't mean that exactly those Puranas are in the modes of nature, because obviously they're all pure coming from Krishna, but they're meant for people in the mode, 6 in the mode of passion, 6 in the mode of ignorance, and 6 in the mode of goodness. I'm not sure of the breakdown of all of those. I know some like Padma Purana and Vishnu Purana. Obviously, Bhagavat Purana would be classified in the mode of goodness. And then of course, you know, the others. So, taking a step back, we understand that there are 4 sources of knowledge that are actually given in the Srimad Bhagavatam. It's earlier in the 11th canto and other places. First, there's Vedic knowledge, or Shastra. Then there's direct experience, or Pratyaksha. Traditional wisdom, Atihya, and logical induction, Hanuman. So that's a whole another subject in another class. We won't get into that. But the point is that there's acknowledgement of different ways of knowing and understanding both material and spiritual knowledge. And of all of those, what's called Shabda Praman, or descending knowledge given by Shastra, is considered to be the highest. Jiva Goswami in the Tattva Sandarbha gives a very lengthy explanation and, you know, very, very convincing proof of how this revealed knowledge coming from Krishna is the highest source of knowledge, and talks about the different shastras and ultimately into how the Srimad Bhagavatam is the highest. Because through the spiritual sound vibration, Krishna reveals himself. He reveals all knowledge about material and the spiritual worlds. And this knowledge of the highest, the ultimate, absolute truth cannot be known through inductive methods or deductive methods or any practical experience or through oral histories or through common sense or any other methods. So we accept the Shabda Praman, spiritual knowledge descending from Krishna ultimately, as the highest knowledge. Now, within that, in the Vedic literature, there's actually 3 different categories, 3 categories of Praman, or that's also called Prashtanatraya. First is what's called Shruti. Shruti means words directly spoken by Krishna, which includes the 4 Vedas, the Rig, Sama, Yajur, and Atharva, and the Upanishads. There's 108 Upanishads. We all know the Ishupanishad. Prabhupada gave us a translation purport to that. And others that Prabhupada often quotes are ones like Svetashvatara Upanishad, Katha Upanishad, like that. I don't know if we have good translations of those. I'm sure they're around. But we know that these are important works of Vedic knowledge. The Nyaya Prasthana refers to the process of logic, of spiritual logic. Now, I only can think of one literature that sort of fits that logical conclusions about the absolute truth. Anyone can think of one? Anyone come to mind? Vedanta Sutra is one that Prabhupada mentions. It's in this category. I don't know of others, but the Vedanta Sutra, of course, is a logical process of establishing the absolute truth. Then we have Smriti, which we're very familiar with. Smriti is the commentaries, not written directly by Krishna, but written by Krishna's devotees, self-realized souls describing Krishna and the absolute truth, and these conclusions are based upon the Shrutis. So here we have the 18 Puranas as one of the major categories of the Smriti. Includes, of course, the Bhagavat Purana, or Srimad Bhagavatam, and other works like Mahabharata. Of course, Bhagavad Gita is part of the Mahabharata. And so we have this whole group of Vedic literature. And amongst all of these, the Srimad Bhagavatam is considered by the Vaishnavas to be supreme. It is the Amala Purana, or the spotless Purana, because Prabhupada explains it only describes Krishna, Krishna's activities, and the activities of Krishna's pure devotees. And it only leads us to pure devotional service to Krishna. So of those 10 topics, that last one, the Ashraya, Supreme Shelter, or sometimes Prabhupada calls the Summum Bonum, is the subject matter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, or Bhagavat Purana. It's also considered to be the natural commentary on Vedanta Sutra. Others, like Shankaracharya, wrote commentaries of Vedanta Sutra. Say, why isn't there a Vaishnava commentary? And the answer, of course, is Srimad Bhagavatam is the Vaishnava commentary on Vedanta Sutra. So the Srimad Bhagavatam is considered to be a literary incarnation of Krishna. And it's very, very relishable for the devotees to hear. It's described at the very end of the Srimad Bhagavatam, the 13th chapter, text 18. Srimad Bhagavatam is the spotless Purana, Amalam. It is most dear to the Vaishnavas because it describes the pure and supreme knowledge of the Paramahamsas. This Bhagavatam reveals the means of becoming free from all material work together with the process of transcendental knowledge, renunciation, and devotion. Anyone who seriously tries to understand Srimad Bhagavatam, who properly hears and chants with devotion, becomes completely liberated. So I thought that was a very nice, succinct verse that describes the glory of the Srimad Bhagavatam and also the great benefit that we receive from reading it. So we know that Lord Chaitanya constantly quoted, read, described the Srimad Bhagavatam. His disciples, the six Goswamis, all stressed the Bhagavatam above all literatures. It is really the standard of proof. In all the commentaries, such as in Jiva Goswami's Sandarbhas, what does he quote? Srimad Bhagavatam. He'll make a logical point, say this, 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 and that's substantiated by Srimad Bhagavatam. And of course, Vishwamacharya Thakur, all of the followers of Lord Chaitanya use the Srimad Bhagavatam as sort of the gold standard of proof. If it says in the Bhagavatam, that's what we accept. So the Vedic literature and the Srimad Bhagavatam was compiled by Srila Vyasadeva, and that's mentioned here in these verses. And we go back to Bhagavatam 1.3.40. It says, this Srimad Bhagavatam is the literary incarnation of God. It's compiled by Srila Vyasadeva, the incarnation of God. It is meant for the ultimate good of all people. It's all successful, all blissful, and all perfect. And other Puranas are mentioned, including the Vishnu and Skanda Purana, describe how Srila Vyasadeva compiled the Vedas. And of course, the Bhagavatam gives extensive history of Srila Vyasadeva's compilation of the Bhagavatam, as well as all of the Vedic literatures. So Srila Vyasadeva is obviously a very, very important person to the Vaishnavas. We call this, we're sitting on the Vyasasan, we have Vyasa Puja, right? All these things. In other words, one who is a speaker of the Bhagavatam, or one who is accepted as a representative of Vyasa. Because Vyasadeva is the compiler, the speaker, the writer of the Vedic literatures. Therefore, one who is in that place is a representative of Vyasa. So it's a very, very important thing. So, in Chaitanya Lila, we know that so many of Krishna's associates came with Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to enjoy his pastimes. And naturally, Srila Vyasadeva also came. And he came as Vrindavan Das Thakur, whose appearance is today. How was that? Pretty good segue there. I'm going to read a little bit about Sri Vrindavan Das Thakur. I didn't find a whole lot. One thing is mentioned that the Vaishnavacharyas tend to really underplay themselves. You know, they're super humble, and they don't talk about themselves, so you have to get other Vaishnavas who write about other Vaishnavas to learn much about them. In fact, even I remember like Gopal Bhatta Goswami is not even mentioned in Chaitanya Charitamrita because he insisted, told Krishnadas Kaviraj, whatever you do, do not mention my name. I won't even have my name mentioned. That's the great humility that we have. So sometimes we don't know so much about these great personalities, and I didn't find extensive biographical information about Vrindavan Das. It may be around, but so I'll just read a little bit here. Srimad Vrindavan Das Thakur's mother's name was Sri Narayani Devi. Now that's important because Narayani is a great, great devotee of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Narayani Devi was the daughter of Srivas Thakur's brother. When Mahaprabhu revealed his divinity in the house of Srivas, showing his true self to the assembled devotees there, Narayani Devi was only a four-year-old girl. In the Chaitanya Bhagavat, it is written, of course, I should have mentioned Sri Vrindavan Das is the author of the Chaitanya Bhagavat, which is obviously a very, very important work. And Krishnadas Kaviraj, you know, repeatedly refers to the Chaitanya Bhagavat, which was also at the time called Chaitanya Mangala, just to add to our confusion, but they changed it later because Lochan Das Thakur wrote Chaitanya Mangala, so they changed Vrindavan Das Thakur's Chaitanya Mangala to Chaitanya Bhagavat. So that, you know, so that we have these three great literatures about Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Okay, so the golden moon, Sri Gauranga, revealed himself as the soul of all souls. At that time, he ordered Narayani to chant the name of Krishna. Although she was only 4 years old, she became mad with love of God. Crying, "O Krishna," she swooned in ecstasy. As she laid in the ground in a trance of bliss, her eyes filled with tears, overwhelmed with divine love. Narayani Devi's son was Vrindavan Das Thakur. In the Chaitanya Bhagavat, he has written of how Narayani was the object of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's affection. Indeed, it was by the mercy of the Lord's prasad that Vrindavan Das Thakur took birth in the womb of Narayani as the incarnation of Vyas. Sri Gauranga and Sri Nityananda were the very life and soul of Vrindavan Das Thakur. In his commentary on Chaitanya Bhagavat, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur says, at the ancestral home of Malini Devi, the wife of Srivas Thakur, Vrindavan Das played as a small boy growing up. There he was nourished and cared for just like a valuable gem. While Vrindavan Das was still within the womb of Narayani, she became a widow. Now, and it says we don't know too much about his father because he actually died before Vrindavan Das was even born. In the small room of a poor Brahmin, she lived in great poverty and hardship as a maidservant in the house of Vasudev Dutta. Vrindavan Das Thakur was born and soon began his studies. Vrindavan Das Thakur took birth 4 years after Chaitanya Mahaprabhu accepted sannyas, when Mahaprabhu had disappeared from this world and entered into his Aprakriti Leela. Vrindavan Das was barely 20 years old. So he's about a generation younger than Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Soon thereafter, Vrindavan Das Thakur accepted initiation from Sri Nityananda Prabhu. He is Nityananda's eternal servant. That's interesting. I just thought of Krishnadas Kaviraj is also initiated by Nityananda, isn't it? So Nityananda, of course, is the original spiritual master, being Lord Balaram, and his two of his great disciples are Vrindavan Das and Krishnadas Kaviraj, who are compilers of these great biographies. The poet Sri Krishnadas Kaviraj writes of the endless glories of Vrindavan Das Thakur. This is in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Krishna's life was written in the Bhagavad. Of Vyas. The Veda Vyas for Sri Chaitanya was Vrindavan Das. Vrindavan Das has called his book the Chaitanya Mangala, now called Chaitanya Bhagavat. Whoever hears his book, no grave misfortune shall befall. Who reads it knows the glories of Chaitanya Nitai and knows what Krishna Bhakti is, how it is, and why. His book contains the essence of the holy Bhagavat and shows what Krishna Bhakti is and what Bhakti is not. An atheist who hears the Thakur's words will soon relent and join the ranks of saintly men whose souls are heaven-sent. No ordinary man can sing of God as he has sung. The Lord himself has spoken through the Thakur's holy tongue. I don't know if it's from Chaitanya Charitamrita or not. Anyway, I bow a million times before the holy lotus feet of Sri Vrindavan Das, whose verses are so sweet that one who reads them shall be freed from this dark mortal earth. I bow a million times before the place where he took birth. Okay. Who's it from? Dravidic, you think Dravidic? Because it's put in English rhyme, so it's not obviously the original word. So, okay, it's probably Dravidic's, poetization of the words of Krishna's Kaviraj. Very interesting. Anyway, wonderful, amazing devotee, as they all are. Srila Vyasadeva coming in Chaitanya Leela, and also continuing his same service of writing, compiling the glories of the Lord. Okay. So I'm going to return to text 21, which we should probably read again. Either automatically or because of one's regulated spiritual practice, one's mind may stop functioning on the material platform of waking consciousness, sleep, and deep sleep. Then one understands the Supreme Soul and withdraws from material endeavor. So, in the purport, this verse is quoted, and the Vaishnavacharyas quote this verse as well from Bhagavatam. Bhakti and devotional service dissolve the subtle body of the living entity without separate endeavor, just as a fire in the stomach digests all that we eat. So this is the example that's given. So this is, we're talking about the dissolution of the subtle body. I think probably we could think of it more as transformation. It's not that the subtle body is like, well, it is gone. Anyway, we'll get to that. So this transformation of the subtle body. The identification with the subtle body is probably our greatest impediment in spiritual life. Even more than identifying with the gross senses, the body, the five gross elements, probably even a stronger identification is identification with the subtle body, particularly the mind, intelligence, and false ego. You know, I've often said this, it's probably easy, at least for devotees, and for many spiritualists or people who are pursuing a spiritual path, to understand they're not their body. You know, I feel very fortunate to know we're not our body. But, so that's something that we can concede. All right, I'm not just this body, just what's happening. There's something beyond that. There's some higher consciousness, some higher awareness. But to become free from the concept that I'm not my mind, not my intelligence, not my ego, that's a little more difficult. Because we tend to identify very strongly, particularly with the mind, the process of the mind are thinking, feeling, and willing. And when we are thinking, contemplating, when we are experiencing feelings, emotions, whatever it may be, and when we have desires, we tend to think this is us. Even as devotees, we think this is me, right? But it actually isn't. It's the subtle body operating within this material world. Now, what happens to that subtle body? The subtle body becomes spiritualized, becomes transformed in the process of bhakti yoga. So, just as digestion of food requires no separate effort, liberation automatically accompanies attainment of bhakti, is this verse that's being given. Now, this particular section of the Bhagavatam in the third canto, 25th chapter, is, well, this part of it, it's a wonderful chapter. It's called The Glories of Devotional Service or something. You know, it's a really, really nice chapter. There's so many. Such a nice chapter of the Bhagavatam. But this particular part of it is talking about the superiority of bhakti over mukti, or liberation. Okay. And this is one of the things that is cited about how bhakti dissolves the subtle body, purifies one almost automatically. An example is given of digesting food, how it requires no effort. So Srila Prabhupada says, the example is given here that the fire in the stomach can digest whatever we eat. If digestive power is sufficient, then whatever we can eat will be digested by the fire in the stomach. Similarly, a devotee does not have to try separately to attain liberation. And very service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the process of his liberation. Because to engage oneself in the service of the Lord is to liberate oneself from material entanglement. It's a subtle point. In other words, if you're serving Krishna, you are liberated. That's what liberation means. To serve Krishna, not to be serving the material body, material senses, this material world. So when one begins the process of bhakti, of devotional service, liberation is automatically there. Now, this transformation of the subtle body, and interesting, Srila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, in his commentary on this verse, explains this a little bit more. I thought this was quite interesting, and it's a good explanation. He says that bhakti destroys the subtle body, kosha. However, the distinction of this liberation from liberation caused by jnana is shown with an example. It is like the fire of digestion devouring edible items like food. Having no alternative for nourishing the body, the fire of digestion destroys only the useless portions of the eaten food, but nourishes the life bearers, senses, and I have something got scrambled here, dietas, by the good portions of the food. By this, the body gains strength of muscles, senses, and mind. Similarly, bhakti destroys only the bad portions, the material aspects of sound and other sense objects, the material senses and material sense objects. It does not destroy the good portions of sound or other sense objects and natural senses which are related to the Lord. Chakshu-shas-chakshu-uta-strutas-strotram. The Lord is the eye of the eye and the ear of the ear. By these senses, objects, and senses, the spiritual body of the devotee appears. Therefore, when the scripture talks of the destruction of the body and senses, they refer to the material aspects of the subtle body. Right? So this is what's happening. It's not that the entire subtle body is destroyed, but the material aspects are, and they become spiritualized, you know, and become as they're engaged in Krishna's service. Because if you think about Srila Prabhupada, or you think about a great devotee, it's not that they weren't operating with a mind, an intelligence, right? They had an identity. I mean, otherwise, that would be impersonalism, right? Impersonalism is that, you know, there is no mind, there's no intelligence, there's no senses, there's nothing. It all becomes one spiritual, you know, homogenized mass or something. Now, that's impersonal philosophy. As personalists, Vaishnavas understand, yes, there's spiritual mind, there's spiritual intelligence, and spiritual identity. In fact, that spiritual identity is there eternally. It is there from the very beginning, as described in the Bhagavad Gita. Never was there a time when you or I or all these kings did not exist, nor in the future shall any of us cease to be. So the eternality of the soul, its separate identity and separate existence, is established right from the beginning by Krishna. So that's there. But that spiritual identity becomes covered in this material world. When we enter in this material world, first, of course, the contact with false ego in the Mahatattva comes about, and everything else proceeds from there. Once we have this false identity with matter, once we start to think, I am separate from Krishna, I am different from spirit, and we take on this false identity and acquire the gross and subtle material bodies. So this is the process. And so kind of the reverse process of that, of getting out of this attachment, getting out of this entanglement, is by the process of bhakti yoga. So how do we achieve a spiritual body? How do we, I guess, regain the original spiritual body, which is really latent within us? Right now, the spiritual body, the spiritual sense, they're there, but they're covered. They're completely covered by these material, you know, gross and subtle body coverings. So we have to reverse that process, and that's done through the practice of bhakti yoga, specifically for us, sadhana bhakti. That's beginning with the process of hearing and chanting. Prabhupada describes this in a book called Beyond Illusion and Doubt. Prabhupada says, because of our ignorance of the spiritual body, of which we have no experience, we do not know of the activities of the spiritual body. If by Krishna's grace we act in our spiritual body, we can transcend both the gross and subtle bodies. In other words, we can gradually train ourselves to act in terms of the spiritual body. As stated in Narada Pancharatra, Rishikena Rishikesha Sevanam Bhaktaruchyate. Devotional service means engaging the spiritual body and spiritual senses in the service of the Lord. When we are engaged in such activities, the action and reaction of the gross and subtle bodies cease. So this is what we experience in bhakti yoga. When we begin the process of devotional service of bhakti, we are transforming the senses, we're transforming the mind, intelligence, to their original spiritual reality. Okay? So, and of course, so many examples are given there. Prabhupada talks about putting the, you know, the iron rod in the fire and it becomes like fire, etc. So this process of transformation or spiritualization of the gross and subtle body goes on through the process of bhakti. There's another nice explanation Prabhupada gives of the steps of this. And this is in a commentary to the Bhagavatam 4.22.25. That verse is, the devotee should gradually increase the culture of devotional service by constant hearing of the transcendental qualities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. These pastimes are like ornamental decorations on the ears of the devotees. By rendering devotional service and transcending the material qualities, one can easily be fixed in transcendence in the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Now, in the purport to this, Prabhupada gives sort of the step-by-step process of how this happens. He says, this verse is especially mentioned to substantiate the devotional process of hearing the subject matter. We can increase our propensity for devotional service by hearing the Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam from realized souls. The more we hear from realized souls, the more we make advancement in our devotional life. The more we advance in devotional life, the more we become detached from the material world. The more we become detached from the material world, as advised by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the more we increase in attachment for the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Prabhupada explains things just so practically and simply, doesn't he? And what could be more clear than that? I was actually thinking about it and kind of breaking this down, this purport, and Prabhupada actually gives us four steps in the process of sadhana bhakti. First of all, he talks about hearing the Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, but from a realized soul. And I was thinking this kind of corresponds with the beginning processes of sadhusanga, of shraddha, having faith in the process, associating with devotees. Then we advance in the process of devotional service. That's, of course, Bhajana Kriya, the process of hearing and chanting. Then Prabhupada says we become detached from material world. That's the process of anartha nivritti. And then we become attached to Krishna. Or, you know, after anartha nivritti, then nishta, one becomes steady, then attachment, ashakti, ruchi, and then, of course, all the higher stages proceed from there, eventually on to bhava and prema. But that begins from the preliminary processes of bhakti, of sadhana bhakti, vaidhi bhakti, where one systematically engages in Krishna consciousness through hearing, chanting, and the other processes. Then these steps automatically arise. So it's a very easy, systematic process as given to us by Srila Prabhupada in line with the acharyas, in line with the Vedic literatures, which helps us to more and more purify the mind, the intelligence, the false ego, and transform them to their spiritual reality. And that is in that way the subtle body is dissolved, so to speak. So, as most of us have experienced, it doesn't always happen overnight. And sometimes it is a gradual process for many of us. But yet, it's a very sure process. It's a process that will work. And going on, Vishnath writes a very, very long purport to that text 33, and he talks about this gradual process, continuing the analogy of the fire and digestion. And I thought this was kind of a nice analogy to think about this. He says, just as the fire of digestion, from the moment the food is eaten, begins digesting it, but completes the process after 9 or 12 hours, right? In other words, digestion begins, but it takes some time, you know, completely finish. So from the very beginning of devotional service, bhakti begins to destroy material life in the form of lamentation and illusion, but completes the process of destruction only after some time. Then even at the stage of practice, the lamentation, illusion have not yet been destroyed, one should not consider the devotion, the devotee, to be in samsara or illusion, be caught in the cycle of material birth and death. So even though, just as the food's still digesting, we're still in this process of purification, the process has nevertheless begun. And just as the food will digest in due course of time, at least if you're normally healthy, so the process of sadhana bhakti will work in due course of time. And this time, this process, you know, is obviously very individual. Depends upon our commitment to the process, depends upon our sincerity, and also depends upon the mercy of the spiritual master and the Lord. Someone was mentioning the other day in one of their classes this week that it's not a mechanical or automatic process. You know, that we achieve the process of purification by the mercy of Krishna. There is no other means, there's no other... In fact, our acharyas have talked about that this process of bhakti is completely dependent upon kripa, dependent upon mercy. There's no other means. But how do we receive that mercy? How do we receive the blessings of the guru, the blessings of the spiritual master, Krishna? And this happens, of course, by showing our sincerity, showing our desire to become liberated. I think we have a little loose wire here. And we show that sincerity through our process of sadhana, through the process of hearing and chanting. Krishna sees, the Guru sees, you know, we are chanting the holy names of the Lord, we are hearing the glories of the Lord, we are trying to serve the Lord, practical devotional service. And that way, we gain the attention of Krishna. At least hopefully we'll gain the attention of Radharani, and Radharani will recommend us to Krishna. You know, it's very hard for us to access Krishna directly. But we do have the guru, we have the acharyas, the parampara system, we have the mercy of Radharani, and in the mercy of Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda. In all this way, there's so much help and so much mercy available to the devotees to be able to complete this process of purification. Even though, as we've been reading this 12th canto, it's very, very difficult in this age of Kali. We have so many things against us. It's like we have every disadvantage, very few advantages in spiritual life. But we do have, of course, the one great advantage, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu coming and giving us this Sankirtan Jagya, this chanting of the holy name. And through the process of chanting Hare Krishna, even those of us in this Kali Yuga who are very, very filled with material desires, lifetimes of conditioning, somehow or another we're able to take to this process of devotional service and begin the process of purification. So that the subtle body becomes dissolved little by little, and we're able to eventually realize Krishna. As one says, after this happens, one can understand the Supreme Soul and withdraw from material endeavor. Okay? I'll stop at that point. Yeah. Ragatnika?
Thank you, Prabhu. When I think of the mind, intelligence, and false ego, as you were describing, the false ego occurs when mind identifies with the gross body, the subtle body identifies with the gross body. So if that's what false ego is, why is false ego a separate kind of entity? Mind, intelligence, and false ego.
My understanding is that false ego comes first. You know, originally it was false ego, which is the identification. The identification of matter, and also the conception that I am separate from Krishna, separate from Krishna's desire. I am enjoying independently. Then there's the creation of the other elements, including the mind and intelligence. So the mind and intelligence simply
you know, help the false ego, you know, in this false identification. So, you know, it's they are separate, and of course they're increasingly more subtle as well. You know, but they all have their spiritual reality. There's the spiritual mind intelligence, and of course there's real ego, the spiritual identity that we reestablish. Much more insight
than that. I just wanted to ask for a question also. Those classes are very wonderful and very enlightening. So one question leads to another. For myself, I believe
could you speak directly?
Okay.
Turn to the microphone.
Okay. False ego, talking about the false ego, the false identification with the false identity, I suppose. But somehow or other, sometimes we have to use it in Krishna service. Like, if I identified I'm a servant of Krishna and I serve Srila Prabhupada, I have a pride for that. It's like create another kind of ego.
You're saying sometimes we identify with our service?
No, identified as a servant of Krishna, suppose.
Yeah.
I offer flowers to Srila Prabhupada and I believe, receiving the mercy, I developed this enlightenment that I have an identity as a servant of Krishna and I'm proud of it. You
yes.
know? That is proper, right?
Because sure. Yeah. In other words, there is real identity. And we should have that identity as servant of Prabhupada, servant of Krishna, servant of our guru. Yes.
And that's beneficial. That helps us in Krishna consciousness.
It comes and goes on its own sweet will. Okay. Any other? Oh, DTD move.
Yeah. Well, it's like in the descriptions we've been discussing it, we've also heard that, you know, the jiva has its autonomous reality, and then it gets covered in its conditional sojourn. It gets covered. You know, we describe it like that. So it sounds like, you know, the jiva has real ego. And it sounds like, you know, we hear these pastimes, you know, they have mental, something we identify as mental proclivities and intellectual proclivities.
Yeah, in other words,
so,
these things are inherent within the Atma, yes.
Yeah, I mean, we see symptoms of these proclivities that we would identify with those terms. So if considering, sometimes we describe the jiva then gets covered with a false ego, it means the ego is now covered to think it's something it's not, and the mental and intellectual proclivities instead of, you know, are then directed towards conditional pursuits, and then we purify these things, you know, as opposed to, I don't know, you know, it's like, who knows what's going on, but just how to think about them a little bit maybe in different ways. We're purifying these things, perhaps. And it's not like they're not... The false ego, the conditional sense of intelligence, is separate from the self, but it's a covering, perhaps, on proclivities that are centered to the self. Maybe one.
Yeah. I think if I'm hearing you right, you may begin to, is there sort of a subtle distinction? In other words, are they separate? Is there material intelligence and is there spiritual intelligence, or is one simply a transformation or a covering of the other? Is that what you're saying, sort of? Or?
Yeah, because we say real ego. I mean, we think of ego as a bad thing, but the jiva has a sense of self.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then false ego, it's now twisted in a different direction.
Right.
So I'm not saying it's a separate ego. It's not a separate ego in the original sense.
I think the understanding is that they're not separate, because that's what we're talking about, transformation of them. You know, in other words, they become transformed from their material aspect to the spirit, to the original spiritual aspect, which is kind of the uncovering process as we uncover the reality and dissolve the material, the material aspect.
Again, I'm just playing with the words, but I guess another way I guess we could also say purifying these things.
Right.
To uncover the actual healthy, normal.
Yeah, Prabhupada uses that term all the time,
this
idea of purification.
purification of the senses. We don't really. That's why when it's termed the dissolution of the subtle body, why I wanted to kind of clarify that we're not dissolving it in the sense that it was destroying it. And the commentators, Prabhupada and Vishwanath Chakravarti, said the same thing, that it's really a purification and transformation of the material subtle body to its original spiritual aspect. Yeah, you know, and if one of the most interesting descriptions I've ever seen about this, about the Atma, is in the Paramatma Sandarbha, which the first half is really about the Atma and the second half about the Paramatma, where Jiva Goswami explains all the attributes of the Jiva and talks about how, you know, having volition, having awareness, consciousness, all of these things, in other words, which would indicate, you know, all the full awareness that we connect with mind, intelligence, identification, but they're in its pure spiritual form.
Yeah, and this is a cover of the question.
Right. Yeah. Thank you. Interesting. Maybe one more. Yeah.
So you were also speaking about a spiritual body. So do we have also the spiritual body now and it just covered over, or when you go to the spiritual world, you are taking?
My understanding, yeah, do we have the question, do we have the spiritual body now, is it just covered over? My understanding, it's more or less in a latent stage within us. You know, it's there, but it's latent, meaning that it's unmanifest, in a sense. It's covered, but it's there, ready to come out, ready to emerge. And it has to some degree. You're a devotee of the Lord, so to some degree it has, you know, or to you, probably to you a great degree, some of us a smaller degree, it has emerged. It has, you know, come out, and we're beginning to see, you know, the spiritual body operate. We have in a personality like Srila Prabhupada, you know, I mean, he's in a material body. He appears. He's this older Indian gentleman. But what's really going on, you know, is the spiritual body is completely active and, you know, and operating. Right? Okay. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Yeah.